happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Verlinde, the editor of the Fretboard Journal magazine. And as always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. If you tuned in last week to the amazing conversation I had with Aaron Draplin, you probably know this, but in case you didn't, Fretboard Journal is in the middle of its first ever subscription drive right now. Our goal is to convince as many of you guys out there and gals who have been enjoying the Fretboard Journal podcast and our free videos and all of our free content to finally subscribe to the magazine. So we are pulling out all the stops. We are inviting some of our favorite people back on this podcast. We are showcasing some never-before-seen videos, and we are sharing some actual magazine articles on our website, something we rarely do, to convince you guys and gals to subscribe to the magazine. I hope you will do so. You can go to fretboardjournal.com/support to see all the different packages we have. Subscriptions start at just $30, and they do help us out in a very big way in terms of getting better equipment, being able to do more of these interviews in person, and being able to do more cool stuff, which is what we really want to do for you guys. Today on the podcast, one of our favorite people in the entire world, Mark Stutman of Folkway Music, is on the podcast. We are talking about CITES updates. We are talking about vintage Gibson and Martin repairs. We are talking about the life of a luthier and a small business owner and a lot more. You're going to love it. Mark's been on the podcast before. And next week, I will let the cat out of the bag. We have one of the most epic conversations I've ever had with TJ Thompson, another acclaimed repair person. This is a good one, folks. So if you subscribe to podcasts at all, you're going to want to subscribe to ours, at least for this episode and next week's, because they are some of the best chats I've ever had. I hope you enjoy them. Subscriptions are our lifeblood. I've said it a million times before. It really is what helps us out the most. If you buy it at a store, the wholesaler takes their cut. The freight company takes their cut. We have to pay for postage and everything. By the time it trickles back to us, it's kind of pennies on a dollar. But if you subscribe to the magazine, the money comes straight to us, which helps us out and lets us really flourish and put out more magazines. So that's the logic there. We do have some sponsors, and we do have some sponsors for this very podcast, which is also something I'm very grateful for. First up is Mono Cases. I rock the Mono Vertigo bag. I love, if you don't need a flight case, if you just need a gig bag or a case that you can actually take to gigs without breaking your back, I cannot recommend Mono Cases enough. Like I said, I have the Vertigo, but they have a whole bunch of cases that for every shape and size of guitar you could ever ask for. They are all very protective. They are all very ergonomic, and they all have pockets in all the right places for all of your stuff. So go to monocreators.com to check out their full line of offerings. We also are being sponsored once again by Retrofret Vintage Guitars over in Brooklyn. Retrofret moved. They are now in the Carroll Gardens neighborhood. They have a brand new showroom. And as always, they have some truly amazing guitars. They have a 1938 Martin 0018 for sale right now. They have a 66 Gibson Trini Lopez. Those are such beautiful instruments. And they have kind of an oddball thing, but probably the best value early Gibson you could look for, a 36 Gibson Black Special number 4 arch top. That's an arch top, very plain black arch top with basically an L00 body, but then an arch top on top. Really, really cool guitars. You're going to be the only person on your block with that, and less than $3,000. So if you want an early Gibson, if you want to hear what all the fuss is about, that's one way to get in with a low barrier of entry, I guess. What else can I tell you before we talk to Mark? We, like I said, we have all sorts of cool stuff on fretboardjournal.com and on our Instagram and on our Facebook. The Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. We just released our 19th episode. Tune into that. Give it a try, even if you don't think you care at all about amps. It's kind of the addictive, I guess is the only way to describe it. I co-host it. I talk to Skip Simmons, one of the world's best amp techs, who's based down in California, and it started out with us fielding your questions on why your deluxe reverb is humming when you play at whatever venue. And now we're somehow veering into soup recipes and lifestyle tips and all sorts of other stuff. I know this is not doing it any justice, but it is quite a unique thing. Skip is a character. I'm the straight man. And if nothing else, you will learn something about amplification, but you will also laugh over the course of every episode, which is something that is important. Rest in peace, Daniel Johnston, one of the great musicians, a huge person in my life. I loved his music. And if anybody out there has been reading the obits on him and wants to start somewhere, there's a lot of great Daniel Johnston music, but there's also an incredible tribute album by Kathy McCarty that came out in the early 90s that I've been listening to a lot. She really transforms his songs, and it is a great introduction to a quirky, lo-fi, eccentric musician. It makes it the songs pretty accessible for anybody. So sorry to read that Daniel passed away, but he was awesome. So, all right, I don't want to end on a somber note. Lots of other great things happening in the Fretboard Journal world. Fretboard Journal 45 is going to be coming out in a few weeks. All the people who subscribe now through our subscription drive will be getting that issue. And we have a new electric issue coming towards the end of the year. And our pre-order button, I think, just went live on fretboardjournal.com in under the shop tab. So if you want to nab your copy, they sold out last year. That would be the way to do it. And we have a ton of great stories gear loaded up for that. So, all right, without further ado, here is my conversation with Mark Stutman of Folkway Music. Thanks, everybody, for tuning into the Fretboard Journal podcast. Thank you for leaving us reviews over on iTunes. And most importantly, thank you for subscribing to the magazine itself and supporting us, because we want to keep this going and we want to actually make it better and bigger than it is right now. Mark, thanks for being on the Fretboard Journal podcast.
Hey, Jason. My pleasure. Thanks for having me back again.
No, we're having our first ever subscription drive, and we're bringing back some of our favorite guests as well as some new faces. And
nice.
I wanted to make sure we talked to you.
All right.
So you own one of the great guitar stores in North America, Folkway Music.
Working on it.
What's keeping you up at night as a small business owner?
Beyond my children?
Yeah.
I guess just staying on top of the workflow, to be honest with you. It's the store's thankfully doing real well. We seem to, you know, there's still lots of people who are only now just discovering us, which is lovely. And there's lots of guitars coming and going. We're not wanting for much around here. A few more 30s J35s and jumbos, and maybe, you know, the odd D18 would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
But no, we're busy. It's just the repair backlog is what's keeping me up at night, and not having enough time to get them all done. It's really hard to find enough time in the day. I'm building a shop in my house right now. We have a one car garage that's really just been a storage shed for bicycles and you know, wine bottles that are empty. And so I've been working there trying to make a climate controlled insulated space that I can make into a home workshop. So after I get home at night, I can jump back to work. My store is about a half an hour drive from my house. In the early days of Folkway, I was located about 100 feet from where I lived. But about 7 years ago, we moved here to this other town, the next town over, Waterloo. And so it's no longer convenient to just kind of swing by after dinner and get guitar repair done. So got to change that up and make some repair shop space at home. And I'm looking forward to that. I insulated and built the floor yesterday and got to keep chipping away before the snow starts to fly around here so I can actually get in there this winter. But that'll be great if I can bring home, you know, if I can do neck resets at home at night. That would be good. That'd be a good use of my time and space over there.
I was going to ask, so you do some pretty high-level repairs. You have people sending you guitars from around the continent and probably beyond. Does the really high end hard stuff happen at your, will it happen at your house or will it happen at the store? How do you break that down?
That's going to be seen. I don't know yet. There's a lot of tooling involved in guitar repair. There's a lot of jigs. There's a lot of habitual use of space. So, you know, the way I work on a guitar is very very much caused by the layout of my workbench. And so it's hard to translate your skills from one workbench area to another. You know, if I go down and visit my friend TJ in Boston, he's got nothing but bench space there, and so I might come down and hang out with him for a weekend and, you know, play with guitars, but it always feels weird being in that space. Even though he's got, like, the wet dream of guitar repair shops, it's still hard to work in that space because it's not my space that I'm used to. So I'm going to see how well I can set up that garage and see if I could make it as comfortable as my main bench here at the shop. And we'll see. It's a one-car garage, too, so it's not that much space. So, you know, I'm going to be limited. I can't go putting a big table saw in there because there's not really the space for that and other things. So we'll see. I think I might not do lots of big structural repair there, but things like neck resets that's not much of a structural job. You know, you're not repairing cracks and gluing braces while you're at it. Like, that's something I can do at home easily. And in time, I'll build up the accoutrements that I need to do any job there. But at the outset, I'll probably just stick to things like that. Who knows? Maybe I don't know. Maybe I have this bit of a dream that maybe I'll build a guitar or two. But I think it's a long way off, to be honest with you. We'll see. It's been a long time, so that'll be a really big wheel to start turning again.
So since you're in the midst of this, I got to ask, like, you are, I'm imagining most luthiers are creatures of habit. They know where to reach for their tools and everything. Do you use a blank slate like this to kind of improve what you have at your shop, or are you just trying to replicate what you know and can do, like, blindfolded?
I'll probably do a little bit of both, in all honesty. When I set up this bench here at the Waterloo store 7 years ago, I changed my bench dramatically from what it used to be in the Guelph store. In my old shop, I set that shop up in 1999 when I was 25 and thought I would be a guitar builder for the rest of my life. And it was a guitar building bench, and it just morphed as I bought new tools and made new jigs and things. They just ended up in funny places. Now the new shop, like, there are no tools on the bench in front of me, as so many people that work at benches do. All your tools are, like, in front of you, and you just reach across. But there's a problem in that. If you have some $30,000 guitar on your bench and you reach for your wire cutters and you have a hangover, you know.
Hey, you've already talked about wine bottles, and now you're talking about hangovers. I'm a little worried about you, Mark.
There might be you can encounter problems. You can do irreparable damage, and so. So all the tools are on the side, on the wall next to me. There's a few tools in front of the guitars, but, like, little light things and just nothing heavy and nothing that's going to really hurt a guitar. You know, and the lighting and where the lighting is and how high your benches are. When I built my shop here, I replicated my benches in my old shop at 36 inches, and then I realized that I was getting some back problems, and so I made a little riser that raised me up to 39 inches at my bench, and all of a sudden, like, my body doesn't hurt as much anymore. Even just this past week, I wanted one of these guitar workstation jigs where your guitar is, like, on a pedestal and you can access any side of it. You can walk all around it, sort of almost like a barber chair. StuMac sells a pedestal kind of thing. And there's no space for me to do that here in the shop. We've got other repair people, and I can't just occupy the middle of the room. And so I made this little jig that sticks out from my bench that allows me to position the guitar really at any angle from 0 to 180 degrees. And that way I can work on the nut and without leaning in a funny way, or I could angle it and work on the side without leaning in a funny way. And already, like, I've only used that jig for 3 days now, but it's amazing. I'm already feeling, I feel like my work is, I'm able to be more accurate more easily, you know, and that's important stuff. You know, when you're making the way I make a nut on a Martin guitar, let's say, is I do the rough shaping and then I glue the nut in place and I do all the final shaping with the nut on the guitar because I believe that's the way Martin did it. Like, they're carved in situ and then finished over. And so that's the best way to get the edges you know, the sides of the nut looking right and the curve at the back of the nut to look right. But it's really hard to do if you're working from the side of your guitar. You sort of want to be at the end of your guitar and working on both sides and being ambidextrous, really. Like, I work the treble side with my left hand and the bass side with my right hand. It's sort of a bonus of being left-handed is it's easier to do things with my right hand because that's just the way the world is. But this jig lets me do that. And I if I was to set up, I mean, anything, hindsight's 20/20 with anything, but after 20 years of working at a bench, you kind of figure out over time what is a good addition to the scene and what's a good deletion. And so, yeah, every time you set up a bench, it just gets a little bit better. That's when next time you chat with TJ, ask him about that, because he set up his repair shop and he made it the guitar shop of dream of your dreams, of every guitar repair guy's dream. And so much thought went into every little detail. That's a great question to ask him. He'll have fun telling you all about the all little right. tiny details.
It's like a chef with their knives yeah. properly placed.
Like totally. Like anything that is an ergonomic pursuit, for sure.
Nice. So going back a little bit, about a week or two ago, obviously for folks who don't know, you are up in Canada in the Great White North.
Yeah. Yes,
about 2 weeks ago, there was the big CITES announcement about not Brazilian rosewood, but the other rosewoods not being
right.
impacted. Does that impact you and how guitars
huge.
Flow back and forth?
Well, most vintage guitars aren't made out of Indian rosewood. they're still made out of Brazilian. So it's not going to change that. You still need to get permits for Brazilian rosewood that crosses the border. And I think that in time, CITES will make that easier as well. The permits themselves are not a problem. It's just the simple fact that it takes long to get them. And then and every time you cross the border, you need to get a new permit. So a customer could ship me their guitar after they get their permit. I could ship it back after I get my permit. You can't cross the border twice on the same permit unless you're personally carrying it across with one of these CITES passports that exist. I think in time, the Brazilian rosewood transport of Brazilian rosewood vintage guitars will become easier too. But there's not a very strong lobby a strong lobby for change, you know, for Brazilian rosewood instruments, because people aren't manufacturing Brazilian rosewood instruments. So we'll see. I think it'll happen. I think everything sort of, the CITES folks are not trying to make life difficult for people. You know, that's just not the way that that their job is going to be effective, because they want compliance. And the best way to make people comply is to make things easy. And so they're always trying to figure that out, and their hearts are in the right place, and they're not trying to be a bureaucratic nightmare. So it's a convention that is exercised differently in every country, and there are going to be some hurdles and hiccups there, but all in due time, Brazilian will become easier. But in the interim, 90 days out of that decision that they made, Indian rosewood is going to be back to sort of how it was in 2017, sort of, kind of, meaning you won't need to have a permit to ship Indian rosewood guitars. And I'll tell you, that's going to make being a Canadian guitar salesperson or guitar retail store hugely easier. We do warranty repair for Martin, for Taylor, and, you know, it's hard to do warranty returns on guitars for customers because of the CITES thing. Just getting guitars here for resale is a pain in the butt, because you have to pay all these extra fees for the CITES documentation. And I mean, with Callings, they ship their Indian rosewood guitars to Texas for CITES, something to do with CITES, you know, certification. And then from Texas to Canada, there's an extra shipping cost involved. There's fees involved. So it will make things much better for us here in Canada selling new instruments and needing to return new instruments across the border. We also sell plenty of not vintage guitars to people all over the world. So somebody wants a 70s Martin that's covered in Indian rosewood. Well, now all of a sudden, again, I could sell that guitar to an American without needing them to wait a month for a CITES permit. So we're really excited about it. I'm really happy that that happened. And, we're kind of high fives all around with that.
I can't imagine how complicated this must be.
Oh, it's crazy, for
I mean,
sure. We're, yeah.
No, I was going to say, I know John Thomas, our frequent contributor, has one, but I don't think I've ever actually seen anyone with one of those CITES passports. There can't be that many of them. Maybe
I don't think there's that many of them either. I mean, I've never applied for one because I just don't. I don't travel with my guitar. I'm not a musician. I'm traveling everywhere. But and I honestly don't think that all these, you know, touring musicians actually bother either.
There's a lot of that.
Like how many musicians that are playing guitars actually have CITES passports for all their guitars? I kind of don't think that many do, but like ultimately they're not, you know, we're not the big problem, and enforcement officials know that, and nobody's out to get anybody with this. The only times I've heard of people having instruments confiscated that I know of is because that person maybe wasn't the easiest to deal with at the border, you know. It might have been a personality thing.
Sure.
So thankfully it's never been a big issue, but it has been a big hurdle in terms of retail sales and cost of doing business. And I'm really glad from a business owner perspective, because I do a lot of new instrument sales up here, that I'm really glad to see that is in the process of changing.
For sure.
Yeah.
So what's in your store right now that you're excited about?
Right now, there's a few things around. There's a lot in process that I'm excited about that I just haven't had the chance to finish yet. I mean, I have more L00s in the store right now, or early 30s Gibsons in the store right now than I've had in years.
Wow.
But they're all waiting for me to actually work on them. And so that's a little tricky for me.
Wait, so how does that work? Are you buying basket case L00s, or are people consigning ones that they never got around to repairing, and then you need to
buying,
fix them up?
I'm trading. Like, if somebody comes into my store and they've got some old Gibson, we pretty much, like, we work really hard on making that guitar stay here. And so there's a lot of them. I can fix guitars, and so there's no guitar that's not worth having. The problem is that the values of these guitars are still not high enough to make me fixing them worthwhile, you know. So I've got this one guitar that's so cool. It's an HG20 from 1932, and just an awesomely cool guitar. And thankfully, it doesn't need brace repairs. Like, every brace is tight, which is crazy for an old Gibson. And it doesn't even need a neck reset, which is equally crazy. It needs a bridge re-glue, but it has a section of top that's broken, like a piece of spruce missing from, you know, where your armpit would be on the lower bout. And it's this crazy color that Gibson only used for that short period in 32. And it's really hard to get at, because the way that guitar is built, it has these extra set of sides that are hanging from the inside of the top. And this little piece of broken wood is in between the extra set of side and the normal side. And so I can't get in there to, like, without taking the back off, I can't get in there to support the underside of this repair when I do it. Oh, my God. It's such a huge job to make that go away. And there's no time. And there's no money in that guitar. Like, once it's done, what's it worth? Like, maybe $4,000. So I can't go spending 30 hours repairing a guitar that's worth $4,000. So it just sits here, and, you know, maybe that's the kind of thing I'll take home to my garage once it's built. These things that they don't have that I can just, like, you know, pay myself 4 cents an hour to fix. And just because I want to, you know, that's where the hobby side of this whole thing happens. I got into this whole game because it was my hobby, and then now it's my profession, and all of a sudden I actually have to make money at my hobby. And I find that you can't do something as thorough as you'd like to unless the dollars are behind it. And, you know, repairing small body old Gibsons, the dollars are not usually behind it. And so it's often a money losing pursuit, but it's worth it. So anyways, long and short, I'm sitting on lots of Gibsons. There's four Kel Croydons in the store right now.
Okay.
Which is nuts. I don't think I've ever had four at once. And they range from, like, the most lightweight, crazy, you know, late 29 Kel Croydon to heavier 1931 models, and they sound entirely different. And some need neck resets. They all need braces re-glued. And, some have necks that are spaghetti noodles, and others have really great necks with full-thickness fingerboards. And it's cool to see like I know about all these various changes and when they happened and in the way that guitar is put together and the specifications of braces and bridge plates and top thicknesses and all that, but it's really neat as a show and tell object to have them all here at the same time and show the guys that work here, hey, check out this guitar, look how thick the bridge plate is, look how thin the top is, how the top is graduated from the center to the edges. Like, these things slowly evolved, you know, or quickly, I guess, maybe evolved in those couple of years. And it's neat to see them all. Anyways, we have that. We've got this, I got this really cool sort of pre-Robert Johnson era L1.
Okay.
That same body size, that small body. But from when the L1 just became a flat top, the L1s were, you know, it was an arch top instrument, the arch top and back. And then they went to having, they were partially arch top guitars. They had a flat, they had this sort of flat top with arch back thing, and then they went to this the regular flat tops, but those very first flat tops with their H bracing, and huge, strangely wide necks, and they were weird guitars, totally weird. And so this one is like the first, the earliest one I've seen that has like the rubbed sort of Cremona sunburst that we're used to seeing on those late 20 small Gibsons.
Yeah.
It's the earliest one with a sunburst, and it still is H brace, but it has some neat more modern features to it, and it needs one of everything. Like, every brace is loose, and it needs a reset, and the bridge has fallen off of it, and there's missing binding. Like, it's in rough shape.
All
it's
right.
Going to be a long job, but it's a neat guitar to see from the whole continuum of Gibson models.
I won't so ask cool. you how that sounds, yeah.
Yeah, don't. Yeah, it'll be a long time before I can tell you what that sounds like. I've got this. We have a refinished J35 in the store that is a really cool guitar. I'm looking forward to getting done. It's not a gross refinish. It's a really nicely done one that somebody cared enough to do really well. And oh man, there's lots of that kind of stuff. But no advanced jumbos right now. Last time we talked, I think there were 3 advanced jumbos in the store, so there are none right now. So that's, you know, a little less exciting, but I don't know, every day there's something new and interesting that shows up. It might not be an old Gibson, maybe it's some cool 50s Fender or whatever, but there's interesting stuff to learn and look at
yeah.
all the time, which is a fun perk of the job.
So these Kel Croydons, just to go back, from
yeah.
10 feet away, do they look identical, or are they different models?
Oh, they look identical from 3 inches away.
Okay.
You know, they all, with the exception of the neck thickness, the earliest Kel Croydons had standard thickness fingerboards, and then maybe 200 batches, 200 factory order numbers later, they had the skinny noodle neck, you know, the half thickness fingerboards that Gibson's had,
mm-hmm.
and around that time that Kel Croydons all had, and so that's a visible difference. But aside from that, you don't really see too many differences between these things. It's really when you look inside the guitars with a mirror or with measuring tools that you really notice the difference, for sure.
So is there, I know this is a really subjective thing, but, you know, there's all these vintage instruments that we see Joe Henry play or whomever, and we are like, I want that L00, I want that whatever. And I know it's all in the ear of the beholder, but is there a sweet spot in terms of, you know, when you look at those 4 Kel Croydons, does one stand out? Is there a formula where you're like, you know, this is where they nailed it?
So it depends on what you're after in your ears, you know. And in my opinion, the whole allure of those Kel Croydons, those Gold Sparkle L2s, those L1s, they're the very first ones. They're the ones built in late 29, when Gibson switched from the small body to the larger body L size, around the factory order number 9460, 9490, 9500, right around there,
okay.
is when Gibson switched to their large body. And that's when, similar to Martin's sort of OM models, that's when everything was accidentally, magically wonderful. And they built those guitars so lightly. They're X brace, but the braces are teeny tiny. The tops are thin. The bridge plates are tiny. They're not for everybody. You're a flat picker, and you want an old Gibson. Don't buy one of those things. It just won't work for you. It'll just sound wiry and and it won't have the headroom that you want. Like, they're just not for that kind of playing. But if you want a guitar that just has this wonderful, this crazy, wonderful, open, smoky warmth that, it's so hard to describe. I mean, on my website, I use the word rich and warm and dark and smoky, like just way too much, but I can't think of other words to use. You know, there's this thing that happens, and the overtone, like incredible overtone development. So you're not into overtones, forget about it. There's just a certain thing about those guitars that sounds unlike anything else that you'll ever hear. And it's just because it's so lightly built. It's essentially a really lightly classical, like lightly built classical with steel strings on it, is what those guitars are. And by the time, a half a year later, the braces got bigger and bridge plates got bigger and everything got, they're still phenomenal guitars, and they're way more lightly built than anything from the mid-30s, but they're just different. Those are guitars that you can flat pick. See, I don't personally own one of those 1929 or early 1930 12 fretters, because I'll overpower it. I can't make them sound good the way I play, the way I like to play. But I, you know, when I'm play testing them, and I totally get what they're about. And when you hear someone who plays those guitars for what they do, you really get it. Like Joe Henry, for example, or my friend Rose Cousins, who had me search for a long time for a Kelcord, and that was like this Birds model that I had once upon a time. And it just works, and they're really inspiring for songwriters, really inspiring for songwriters. They're perfect for that role. But they're not lead guitars, you know. And I flat pick guitars, and I want something that's powerful and hoppy and has overtones, but is a really strong fundamental. Those are the kind of guitars I play. So I don't play one of those. My 12 fret Gibson's from 32, which is pretty late for a 12 fretter, but it's built a little bit heavier, and it can handle a much harder right hand attack, in my case left handed, because I play left handed, and they have more pop and more power down low. You can play lead guitar on them. They're sort of, I would say, more along the tonal spectrum that you would hear in David Rawlings' land. You know, they have poppy mid range, dry, clear fundamental, power, great treble. Thickness, you know, that's sort of what I like on a guitar. And so I've got a 12 fret, you know, from 32, and I've got a 14 fret from 33, and which are just the two magic guitars for me. But we're all different, you know. I would say though that there are great later 30s Gibsons, but I would love to see the vintage market sort of learn the difference between the early 30s and the late 30s. An L00 is not just an L00. The same way an OM is not an OM. You know, a 1930 OM is a very different animal than a 1932 OM. And they're the same changes apply. That, I mean, I think we talked about this maybe on the last
podcast. We did, yeah.
But yeah, there's, you know, so few people have played enough of these things to get that there are the differences from year to year, from early to late, are so significant that they should, you know, they should have some impact on pricing. There's just not enough of them out there for people to have had enough experience with them. But those of us who specialize in these things, we sort of know that. But yeah, so it's neat to see. So it's cool to see these Kelcroydians spanning the course of 2 years and see how they change, and mix that in with like a mahogany LO or an L1 that's in the store. There's got to be, there's a 13 fret. We've got a 13 fret L00 still. I had that one last time we chatted too, and it's
still there.
It's in process.
Okay.
It's still here. It got backburnered pretty heavily for a while, but it's going to get front burnered again soon. I don't know, it's just neat. It's really cool to see all that stuff all at once and document it all.
So every, you know, self-professed and amateur guitar collector, acoustic guitar collector knows that in the 70s and 80s, bracing got heavier because of warranty issues, and companies wanted, you know, it's just, everybody yep. knows that. For yep. these guitars that are so extremely lightly braced, how have they held up? Is it defy the odds, and are they, you know, anomalies in that they actually are still structurally sound?
So, sort of, yeah. Many haven't held up.
Okay.
And that's why you see, if you look at Gibson Jumbos from 1934... like, good luck finding one that the top still has a nice arch and its original bridge is its original plate and no top deflection. Like, it just won't happen. Because those guitars were built like a big L00, the tops were, you know, 20% thinner than what they were 2 years later, and they couldn't handle string tension, and so they fell apart. Second to that, you see guitars that have cracks and some that don't. So any vintage guitar that's got cracks is probably built in the summer, and ones that don't have cracks are probably built in the winter, and really. The fact that winter guitars last is super apparent here in Canada, and super apparent with, in particular, these very early Gibsons that didn't have a lot of structural integrity at the outset. If a guitar is built with a radius to its top, and the guitar dries out, the first thing that happens is that radius becomes less of a dome and more flat. And a lot of the strength in a Gibson top is due to that radius. That radius puts strength in a top, and which is why these guitars were able to get away with having such light construction, because they had this radius top. If that radius flattens out, all of a sudden you're asking a lot more of that X brace and other braces, but the X brace in particular, to support. And that's not really fair to the braces, and particularly these very early 30s Gibsons where the braces, the glue surface is between 150 to 200 thousandths of an inch wide, which is like nothing. They just don't have enough strength, and they let go, and that's why you have Gibsons that have X braces that have let go at the upper part and a lot of caving around the sound hole. If a guitar is built right and nice and dry and it dries out, it won't dry past the point of flattening its top out. So keeping the radius alive on a top that's built with a radius top is super critical to the guitar's long-term life. And I think that's a biggie. I don't even know how we got onto that topic.
No, I want to keep talking about it. I mean,
but that's my take on that one for sure.
You know, we've discussed this before when you've been on the podcast, but there are, you know, I feel like the classic Martin sound is something that isn't easy to replicate, but a number of people, you've mentioned TJ Thompson, there's Martin themselves, pre-war, like it's a sound that we can get close to the vintage sound pretty uh-huh. well. With Gibsons, uh-huh. it's such a different, an old Gibson never sounds like a new Gibson recreation never really sounds like an old Gibson, at least to my ears.
Yeah.
If our friends over at Gibson, who I should add are sponsoring this podcast amongst some others, if they hired you as a consultant, let's say, how close could anyone get there in 2019 or 2020? Could you, with enough time and materials and effort, nail that old sound?
I'm hopeful that I could, but I think that it would be maybe a little, pompous, for lack of a better word, to think that I actually could. There's magic in those old guitars. That magic was maybe in the wood. It was maybe in the craftspeople to build it, maybe in the glue, maybe in, you know, how much glacial ice there was. I mean, I don't know, but it's possible. Yes, I can blueprint a guitar, and yes, I can physically build a Gibson that would be identical to an old early 30s Gibson. You can map all that out. Would it sound the same? I don't know, man. I really don't know. Maybe this is why I haven't started building guitars yet, because maybe I don't want to find out. But age does so much to a guitar. String tension over time. Torrified woods are helping. There's no question. Guitars made with torrified woods sound great. I think that's part of it, torrified woods and hide glue, using old wood to start with. But I think just string tension on the guitar, the shrinking of the celluloid over time, all these things, the fret wire that's used, you know. I've changed fingerboards on guitars, and it's completely changed the guitar, for better or for worse, but just changing a fingerboard can have such a huge effect on the sound of a guitar. I don't know. There's hubris there. I don't think that we can say that we can make an old guitar, a new guitar that sounds old. But I think that I can get pretty darn close if I was given the materials and the time and the budget to do it. But I'm sure some would be really close and others would suck, is what it would come down to. And eventually you get better and better. But yeah.
And you mentioned the fingerboard thing. Have you ever regretted changing a fingerboard?
From a tone perspective, I have.
Wow.
Yeah, I have on a couple guitars. I've regretted changing bridges on a couple guitars too. The mass of a bridge makes a huge difference to the sound of a guitar. And sometimes you get a guitar that just sounds magical. It needs a neck reset, the saddle is really low, and the bridge has been shaved down to 3/16 of an inch.
Sure.
But the guitar sounds incredible. And so your logic as a repair guy is, hey, I'm going to fix this, and I'm going to make this thing play as well as it sounds. And so you reset the neck and take that pancake of a bridge off, and you make a replica bridge. I'm pretty good at making bridges that look exactly right and are dimensionally identical. And sometimes it doesn't work out, and you have a good, just doesn't sound as good as it could, or it did as good as it did before. I mean, maybe part of it is the strings were 14 years old and they sounded incredible.
Mm-hmm.
This is the challenge with guitar repair, is that, the enemy of good is often better. And that's a long, hard lesson to learn. Sometimes you just want to leave things alone if it sounds good. Maybe this is what you talk about with Skip, too. I don't know. But, sometimes when cap values drift in an amp, that's what makes that amp magical, And the same thing is true with guitars. Sometimes these terrible old strings and these bridge pins that fit badly and the nut that has a gap underneath it and the saddle is not glued, maybe that's why that guitar has that magic. And when you make a properly fit saddle that's glued in and a nut that fits right and frets that are actually seated, maybe you take that vibe away. Frequently, and more often than not, when you do all that, the guitar is that much better. I'm not trying to say the guitar repair is not necessary, but I mean, my track record is 95% of the time, when you make a guitar better, it's better, and it's a lot better. And that's sort of what I go by. But every now and then you get this one guitar that just is magical, and you can kind of tell when you meet that guitar for the first time. You can tell just from looking at it, playing at it. I say, like, buddy, like, don't fix this thing. It's incredible. Don't change anything here, because it's such a magical piece of guitar, music-making, guitar. Most often than not, you can make them better. But, those every now and then, those guitars. So that takes me back to wondering, hey, like, what else is in there that's making a guitar sound great? Which is part of why I won't say, yes, I can make an old Gibson, a new Gibson that is just like an old one. I don't think it's very easy. But, it's an interesting lesson to learn over the years. It's sort of like the wisdom of a guitar builder or repair guy. And I'm only hopefully halfway through my career here. I think there's a lot of wisdom left to learn. But where I'm currently at is that there are magical guitars, and sometimes that magic is not something that you should play with.
It sounds like at least a few times you've had to tell a customer, like, don't mess with this.
Yeah, I do. And it's not just because I'm busy. It's not infrequent. I have no tolerance for guitars that don't work properly. So if you have a guitar that's messed up and sounds magical but just doesn't work, you can't play it. Well, I'm sorry, magic or not, if you're not going to play the guitar, there's no sense. Mm-hmm. We'll try to find that magic. I have kept, 10-year-old strings and put them back on after I finished a neck reset, let's say. Because there's a lot of good that comes out of dead strings on certain guitars. And a lot of players don't want their strings changed ever. Like, don't mess with that mojo. Those are my strings. That's my sound. And that's fine. I can deal with that. But, yeah. I don't even know where I was.
We famously never ask anybody about strings just because it seems really boring. But since we're talking about relatively niche guitars, these vintage Gibsons, do you have a favorite string that you put on the guitars when you aren't trying to save 10-year-old strings?
My favorite strings are now called Darko D220. And Martin rebranded all their strings, and those were the strings that were called the M540s. They're regular Fosser Bronze Lights. They're also called Clapton's Choice. In their redoing of their string line, they have changed that M540, and they basically call that string now the Darko D220. And it's a Fosser Bronze. It's a plain old Fosser Bronze string with no fanciness going on with the plain strings. It doesn't have coatings or high carbon steel or anything like that. Those are my favorite. Other guitars, those strings to my ear have like a strength to them because of some kind of difference in the core wire. I'm no string scientist, so I don't really know what the difference is, but they feel different, and they feel a little stiffer, and they sound a little thicker, which is always a good thing on a Gibson guitar.
Yeah.
Other guitars, listen, on my one guitar, on my one 12-fret L00, it came in with a dead set of Daddario EJ16s on it, and they were really dead, and the guitar is right-handed, and when I decided to keep it, I had to convert it to left-handed, and so I took those strings off, and I converted the guitar, and I filled and recut the saddle slot, and made a new knot, and I even put side dots in on that one, because I knew I'd never sell it, and I put those very strings on again just because I knew that they were part of the magic of that guitar. And I've never restrung it since. I'm one of those people that doesn't like restringing their own guitars. I don't like the sound of new strings. And every now and then you sort of just have to. But I also, I keep, if somebody comes in for a setup and we're changing the strings and the strings aren't pooched, I'll keep them and I'll save them, you know, for my guitar or for somebody else who wants.
Oh, okay.
You know,
I was going to ask, what happens if you break one on a 10-year-old
set? It sucks. It totally sucks to break a string if you're an old string guy. You know, other guitars, though, are, you know, they just work really great with new strings. But it's not my ear. To my taste, the guitars that I like the best are the guitars that I think are great are guitars that can do old strings well. And there's certain guitars that just can't do old strings well. But other guitars can. But that's just, you know, where I am at in my own evolution as a guitar player. You know, maybe one day I'll be a better guitar player and I'll really want what new guitar strings do. Every good guitar player that I know plays on new strings. You know, there must be something to that.
Maybe.
they want the definition because they can control everything else with their own attack. But I'm too shoddy of a guitar player. So I want dead strings, maybe. Clearly. It hides my errors better. Or something.
Clearly, someone needs to relic strings and package them as such.
Oh, my God, can you imagine? That'd be awesome.
it seems like if enough people are out there.
Relic strings. Oh, my God. We should do that. That could be the next business for Fretboard Journal. You can start marketing relic guitar strings.
All right. I can't wait for the hate mail.
Totally.
You're a bit of a guitar snob. What new guitars are you excited about?
We've had a lot of impressive, neat guitars lately, and you know what? There's been a lot of new. I think the new. I'll speak about acoustics because that's really my wheelhouse. I've been really impressed by a lot of new electrics, but it's just not what I know tons about. I just like electrics and I like playing them. But as far as new acoustics go. There's a lot on the market that's fabulous right now. I have to say one of the most exciting guitars I have in the store, you're going to laugh, but it's a Martin DSS-17. I absolutely love that guitar. It's a 17 series, so it's a fairly budget guitar from Martin. All solid wood, sure, satin finish. It's their slope shoulder thing. It's got a, you know, sunburst, but it has a small little rectangle bridge and a small little bridge plate. It's got scallop braces, and it's lightly built. And it's an incredible guitar. It's just an absolutely amazing sounding guitar. And I was blown away when we got that guitar in our first one of those things. a lot of those 17 series Martins are really nicely built, really lightly built, responsive, warm, really great out of the box kind of guitars. So I've been really, it's nice to see a great sounding guitar at that price point from Martin.
Sure.
They've just redesigned their 16 series, and I've not played one yet. I've not seen them yet. They haven't arrived. But on paper, they should be very exciting. And then, you know, and I still think that their Authentics are some of the best guitars being made, period. You know, the OM28 Authentic is far and away consistently the best guitar in our store whenever we have one. They're just amazing sounding instruments as far as new guitars go. So that's pretty cool. And then, you know, we're a Collings dealer, and we love our traditional series Collings. They're just incredible. And we love our Waterloo Collings. Like, they're all great. So I'm always excited when we get a new Collings model. And we have a few pre-war models that we've never had coming in this week or next. I'm really excited about. And
yeah.
We're getting an O-size pre-war, like an O-18 pre-war. And then we have one of their J models coming in, a short scale.
Oh, I was going to ask.
45.
Yeah.
It's our first one.
You'll be a discerning judge of that.
I might be. We'll see what the pros says on our website once we get it.
Is there a way to tell? Can folks read between the lines about whether or not you're enthusiastic?
I think so. I think anyone who's read our website long enough can tell. It's my voice on the website. Like, I type every one of those website write-ups, right? So anybody who has been following the site for these past 20 years will know.
All right.
When I'm excited about something and when I'm not.
Do you have a stock phrase you use when you're not that excited, but it sounds okay?
I really try to avoid the stock phrases.
Okay.
But if I wax poetic about tone, it's because I should.
Okay.
And if I don't say anything about tone, maybe that's not the guitar's, you know, strong suit.
All right. That makes sense.
It's important for me for our guitars to be accurately described, and there's a lot of bias in my website write-ups. They're really from my ears, and I mean, it's a bit of a problem, really, because maybe I don't like a guitar, but one of our sales guys, JJ or Rich or Mike, they might love the guitar, but they didn't write the website update. You know?
Yeah.
So it's good to have all these different perspectives, but ultimately I'm the guy that wrote the thing. And so if I like the guitar, I'll say lots about that.
All right.
Anyway, so I'm excited to see those. And then, in all honesty, the Grand Pacific, the Mahogany Grand Pacific from Taylor, the 517.
Sure.
That's a killer guitar. They totally got something right on that guitar. I love everything about the guitar. I really like the neck shape on it. They changed the neck shape and gave it a beefier, rounder, again, more Gibson-y kind of feel. It's basically their version of a J45, except that it has a long scale neck and it says Taylor on the headstock, and it has a bolt on neck and, well, okay, lots of other things. But it's just going after the J45 market.
Aside from all that, yeah.
And it sounds really good. Does it sound like a J45? No, it still sounds like a Taylor, but it's a Taylor with a heavy dose of that sort of J45 thump in it, and that what I call thickness in the treble strings, that round, fat, thick treble response, and that sort of thump through the mid-range and the bass. But with a lot of the definition of a Taylor and a little extra power for the long scale neck. There's something about it, though, with that V bracing that they're doing and that tail and the Gibson-y kind of shape. It works. It works really well. So, you know, I have to be excited about all the guitars that we sell. And when Taylor came up with that, I was like, "Hey, look at this! You made a guitar for a vintage Gibson snob to be excited about." I was cool with that. You know. So.
Do you ever get to, you know, I know when I sometimes follow you around the NAMM show, we usually sharing a house together there, but I know you have to talk to the sales reps and, you know, place your orders and everything, but do you ever get to have the direct feedback and back and forth with the Andy Powers or the Bob Taylors or, you know, the actual people who are designing these guitars and tell them what works or what doesn't work as a store owner?
I try.
Okay.
I do try. No. I would love that opportunity. But in all honesty, like, you know who I am, but I'm just some guy that owns a guitar store somewhere and has opinions. I mean, there's a lot of people that have opinions and would like to share them. And so the people who design guitars for these companies, they get nothing but an earful from lots of people. And what makes my opinion any more valid than anybody else's? Nothing. So, no, it would be fun. It would be really fun to get hired on as a consultant for anybody and help in that process. I really love that. But no, I've never really had that. I'm a warranty repair person from Martin, and so I have a bit of a pipeline to their QA department. And so, you know, if I notice QA related things with Martin, I have some effect there. So, you know, if the nut spacing is not as good as it needs to be, or there's, you know, saddle heights are too high or something like that, mm-hmm. I can help, you know, tuners that aren't working right, you know, so that can help. But it doesn't really, I don't have any conduit to helping in the guitar design process. As much fun as that would be like my dream job, but no, I'm nowhere close to that.
All right, companies, you're listening.
Yeah, you can hire tell this them guy. All, okay? Yeah. That'd be fun. For sure.
You talked about the extensive backlog of repair. Do you have helpers on the horizon, or do you have any apprentices or anyone who do you want to go there?
So we have, there's me and two other full-time repair people here, okay, at Folkway. So Grant McBride and Ken and are two other full-time repair guys. And they are each and both amazingly skilled repair people. I'm really glad that they're here, and between the two of them, I think there's 18 or 20 years of time here at the shop. So they're not newbies, and then we have, you know, we have some part-time help that, you know, to do setups, and we've trained them doing setups or small jobs, pickup installs, what have you. I don't have any other buddy helping me. In all honesty, I just can't. I don't have the wherewithal to train anybody else. I don't have the time in my life to do that.
Sure.
Maybe later in life. Did I ever tell you about how I got into this business and me applying, like after I learned how to build guitars, me applying for guitar jobs?
Go ahead. Tell, now that you've planted that seed, go ahead.
I don't know if I told you this on a previous phone call, but so when I finished guitar building, I learned how to build guitars with Serge DeYoung. Yeah. Here in Canada, he's sort of like the Canadian father of guitar builders at this point. It was in 97, 98, early 98, and I was looking for any kind of job with guitar repair people. I didn't tell you this. Oh, man. To listeners who have heard this story, I apologize, but I'm going to say it again anyway. At that point, it was pre-internet, and I basically was a member of Asia, the Association of String Instrument Artisans, mm-hmm. and the Guild of American Luthiers. But anyways, Asia sent out, as part of their membership package, a directory of all their members. And so I took this directory, it was basically a telephone book, and I applied for a job with every guitar builder or repair person, everyone in Canada that was listed, everyone on the eastern seaboard of the United States, in New England, everybody on the west coast of the United States,
jeez,
everybody in the southwest of the United States, which were the places that I would want to live,
okay,
basically. And I sent out 400 letters by mail with a cover letter and a resume. And that's, I applied for jobs. I was, all right, I'm going to get a job doing something with guitars. Anyways, 40 responses of those 400. Of those 40, four people said, hey, you're interesting to me, let's follow up. So four, that's 1%, four out of 400. And then of those four, it led me to one guy who was interested enough that I flew down out west to meet him and hang out there for a week and, you know, fix guitars and just do guitar stuff in a shop for a week. And in the end, it didn't work for a number of reasons. And that was that. And that was the end of this. And And I couldn't find 400 letters, and there wasn't a single person. Now, granted, I didn't have much to offer. I just had learned how to build guitars, and that's, sorry, I'm not bringing much but a keen attitude. So there wasn't, there was nobody that wanted to hire me, and which is why Folkway came to be, because I couldn't find a job, so I just made my job. But what I'm saying with that is that as now the guy who gets resumes and people finishing guitar repair school that want jobs and things, man, I totally get why I didn't get a job back then. I totally get it. Like, there's no time. You don't want to hire somebody. Like, it's really hard unless you're set up as a teaching place to put the resources into teaching someone. You want someone who has the yen for knowledge to learn themselves, you know? And so those people are out there too. But generally speaking, the people that have such a strong desire to make it happen, just go make it happen. You know, they can make it happen on their own, you know? And so, I get why nobody was at all interested in hiring me. And I know why back then in 99, I was offered a job to relocate to a completely different city in a much more expensive city to live in than where I was living, to work for somebody building their guitars for $7 an hour. I mean, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
So it's tricky, and there's a lot of great guitar. There's now, it's a very different landscape. You can learn, there's a few different schools of guitar repair and guitar building now. There's so much available online. Even just hanging out on Stu Mack's YouTube channel, there's stuff to learn there. So there's so many places where someone who's interested in this biz can just go and learn now. That wasn't the case a generation ago. But still, I think I'm going to be a much older person before I take on somebody that resembles an apprentice at this point. Which is too bad, because I'd love to give back somehow. You know, I want to share the knowledge that I've got. I don't really know how to effectively, short of doing podcasts with you and, you know, our Instagram feed. But, bringing on an apprentice is not, unfortunately, not the way that it can be.
Hearing you talk about that, and this could be a whole career counseling podcast episode, which maybe would be more lucrative than talking about guitars. Was there the trial by error, the doing it yourself, like bootstrapping this whole thing? Could that learning curve have been reduced had you worked for a larger company? Are there certain things that, looking back, you're like, wow, for the first 5 years, why was I doing it this way?
Oh, there's no question. No question at all. I mean, basically, my learning curve, so back then in 98, 99, whenever it was, like 3 months after I opened my store, I went to an Asia symposium in Nashville, and I met two people who forever changed my life. One was Craig Korth, who's a Canadian,
Craig.
You know Craig, from Littlefinger.
He's
a Canadian musician. And he turned me on to vintage instruments, which at that point in my life, I was completely unaware of. Completely and totally, I was like, give me a Taylor, give me a Larrabee, I knew nothing. And he turned me on to vintage instruments. He had, he introduced me to Sid Lloyd Lore, he introduced me to Gibson flat top banjos, and he introduced me to heavy picks. Up until that point, I used yellow Dunlop Tortex picks, and hit the guitar harder and harder and harder trying to make it sound good, and just ended up breaking strings. And so he introduced me to seriously heavy, nicely beveled picks and how to hold them, and he taught me how to attack the pick and how to hold my pick and hold my hand and find where your best tone is, which was the single biggest lesson I'd ever learned in that point in my life of having played guitar 20 years at that point. No one ever showed me that. And so from a guitar playing perspective, he was hugely influential and still is to this day. I credit him with, like, everything. Then the same weekend, I met T.J. Thompson. And he was just there, and he had a little table set up. of just stuff that he was selling. He had like guitar tops and guitar parts, and I remember he had a set of banjo tuners, and I picked them up, and he says to me, "You need those." And I looked at him like, "What? Who are you?" Anyways, we hung out, we got to know each other, and he was looking for help too. And so I said, "Well, I'd love, like, this is T.J. Thompson. Even in 1999, he was famous." And so it was a bit starstruck and awestruck. And anyways, I went down and I hung out with him for a week. This was long after that first guy that I didn't work with. And I had a great time. And for a number of reasons, the two biggest of which was, A, I had opened my own store and made a huge capital investment in my own store about 3 months before meeting him. And B, about 3 months, 2 months, whatever, before meeting him, I met the woman who would become my wife. So, I wasn't really keen on moving at that point. But I could have ended up moving there and working with him. But in that 1 week that I spent with TJ in his old shop and was conquered, I learned so much of what I now do for guitar repair, bridge making, neck resetting, just anything you can think of to do with guitar repair. In 1 week of just hanging out with TJ, really set the foundation for everything that followed. And then after that, I went home with the knowledge that I, acquired at that week and went from there, and then practice neck resetting and practice making bridges and practice refrets and replacing bits and pieces on guitars and stuff like that. But that 1 week was my learning curve. And then everything since that week has been self-taught or discussion. You have discussions with other repair people, whomever it is. I mean, maybe it's Frank Ford's frets site that gave me some ideas about things. And you just take little bits and pieces of whatever discussions you have with people or interactions, and you kind of synthesize them with what you've got going on. And there's no question that if I was able to, work with a guy like TJ for a year, that I would have been accelerated by 10 years in my own process of guitar knowledge, maybe even more than that. But people don't have that opportunity. I think that the guitar repair schools that are operating right now are immeasurably helpful. I would have loved to have gone to a place that specialized in finish repair. It's not something that I consider my strong suit. I do finish work. I'm picky about it. I have a good eye for it, but it's not something that I have a lot of skill in. I got good at guitar repair because I was scared about messing up finish, so I got really good at taking guitars apart, so I didn't have to do finish repair. I'm convinced that that's why I'm a good repair guy now, is because I can disassemble a guitar cleanly, so I don't have to do finish touch-up. But that was born out of my lack of knowledge in finish repair, and having someone show me, proper techniques of touching up finish or spraying a sunburst, any of this kind of stuff. Oh man, that would have been huge, These people that are learning how to build guitars now, in places where they actually teach you that stuff, Gallup's Repair Hospital or something, those guys are getting such a seriously good leg up on everyone else. Now they just got to go do it a bunch and practice, and they're going to be unstoppable. They're going to be amazing. So there's lots of potential in the world right now for repair people that are great, and it's really nice that those, between these schools and the internet and the community of sharing, that all these people are getting their hands dirty the right way.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool. Yeah.
Gotta give another shout out to Craig Korth, in addition to being, along with you, one of my favorite Canadians, and living in Nelson, one of my favorite Canadian towns.
Yeah.
He's, I'll run into him at Wintergrass, and he's handing 8-year-olds his Lloyd Lore mandolin or his herringbone or his flathead banjo to try out. And
that's it.
It's incredible. Like, there isn't enough of that going on. And he's such a shared guy.
He's unique. I don't think I've ever met anybody like him in the world. And, pretty special dude. Anybody out there, go meet him.
Yeah. I don't think he listens to this podcast, but he should. I don't know.
Yeah, seriously. You should get him chit-chat with you on a podcast.
I might have to go to Nelson to do that, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's worth a trip, a good little write-off trip to Nelson. Wait till ski season.
Exactly.
There you go.
Well, Mark, you have a lot of repairs to do, and I don't want to hold you from those, so.
All right.
I'm going to let you go.
I should get back on it.
Thanks so much for talking. This was great.
Yeah, my pleasure. Yeah, I'll talk to you whenever next time is.
Yeah, you're one of our recurring guests.
No, hopefully.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Thanks, Mark.
Yeah.
Bye.
Cheers.